Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com.
Fascinating facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, the weekend.
The weekday. I didn't think you were actually going to do it, Lucas. A marvelous Monday to all of you. Welcome to the program. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. Boy, it still feels like the weekend, but it is Monday. Last time I checked, 888-914-9149. It's a toll-free line to talk to me for free on the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. You can also email the program. We're going to open up the mailbag, actually, in just a minute. Got some great emails, but you can email the show as well. Questions, comments, stuff you'd like us to talk about. Cale is the address. Cale, C-A-L-E at relevantradio.com. And you can also tweet at us as well. My personal handle on Twitter is at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And the show account, which is really the producer Lucas Shadow account, at Cale Clark Show.
I take no responsibility for the things that appear on that account.
Yeah, you should, though, because I can go into the computer records and figure out that you did it. But anyways, hey, guess what? It is a mailbag Monday. We haven't done this in a while on the Cale Clark Show. Do you have some sort of a sound effect for this, Lucas? Or
you've got mail.
Yes.
Those are very powerful words.
Yeah, they sure are. Thanks, Tom Hanks. Wow. That's reaching back. Didn't think you were going to pull that
classic
one.
Classic movie. Yep.
Classic. Absolutely classic. Hey, speaking of Tom Hanks, total sidebar here, but did you know that a long time ago, before they made the first Spider-Man movie with Tobey Maguire, way back, long before even this, they were actually going to make a Spider-Man movie starring Tom Hanks as Peter Parker / Spider-Man. And when I first heard that, I thought, wow, that doesn't really make a lot of sense. But it actually kind of does, because if you think about a young Tom Hanks, think about all those films like Big, he can make you laugh and he can make you cry, like in about, you know, a 1 minute span. So I think he would have been able to pull off Peter Parker. But anyways, he would have had to bulk up a little bit maybe for the Spider-Man part. But anyways, that never happened. And we got what we got. And all of the Spider-Man actors are in the latest Spider-Man movie, but I still haven't seen it, so I'm not going to spoil it for myself or for you by talking about it. But we are going to get to your mail questions, and I'm pretty sure none of them have anything to do with the Marvel Cinematic Universe. However, the first one I've got here does have to do with the actual universe itself. And this comes to us from John, who is listening in Los Angeles, California, 9:30 a.m. KHJ. And he actually had an email responding to something that we talked about on Friday's episode. And on Friday's episode, of course, it was the feast day of St. Thomas Aquinas, the angelic doctor. And one of the fun things that we did on Friday's show, and I encourage you to check the podcast, I really enjoyed this part. We looked at different quotes from Thomas Aquinas, some of the best quotes that he ever had throughout the ages, and they resonate just as well today. Even though he was operating in the Middle Ages, it's incredible how much his wisdom comes through to us today and really speaks to our age. And one of the things that we were talking about was he had mentioned something with respect to faith and science, how they don't conflict. And that's certainly the case. Faith tells us the why, you know. The big questions, why did God create the universe? What's the meaning of life? Science tells us how things work, how life works in God's universe. But there is no conflict between faith and science. So anyways, here's John's message. And this is what John said. He said, quote, "I think it's pretty low for you to suggest that young Earth Christianity is, quote unquote, embarrassing." Okay, I'll just jump in there really quick in John's message here. Just in case you don't know what that term means, young earth Christianity, this is the point of view that says that God created the earth, the heavens and the earth, in an actual six-day period, six 24-hour periods. In other words, it's a very literal reading of the first chapter of Genesis. And there are some people, there are some scientists who do think that that is the case, that it actually was six 24-hour periods. And they have scientific theories to back this up. They're known, they think that the Earth is only a few thousand years old. These are what are called young Earth creationists. Other scientists, Catholic and non-Catholic, secular, believer, it doesn't matter, say that the universe is billions of years old and all that stuff. So the young Earth view. Okay, so I did in fact say that word. I think I did use the term embarrassing. Yeah, producer Lucas, you can fact check me on that, but I'm pretty sure I did say that because of the way that the Catholic Church operates and looks at this question, that's never really a problem. And I did, I think I may have actually used that term embarrassing when it comes to the young Earth scientific movement. And, you know, John, probably you're right. Maybe I shouldn't have used that word. Maybe I shouldn't have said that. And by the way, I don't have a dog in this fight. If the young Earth scientific view is correct, great. I really don't care. It doesn't affect my view of things one bit. And I'll explain why in just a minute. If the old Earth view, the extremely old Earth view, is also correct, I'm also cool with that. I really don't have a dog in this fight. It really doesn't matter at the end of the day to me, and I'll tell you why. But anyways, let me just finish the email for a second, and then I'll jump in with more. So John went on to say, quote, "The church fathers were divided on this issue, as were Enlightenment scientists. There is a healthy group of Catholics and good men," like, and then he names this particular guy, "who still entertain a literal Genesis. The church has not taught magisterially on this issue, so it's quite prideful of you to speak ex cathedra yourself." Wow. So first of all, I didn't realize I was speaking ex cathedra. I didn't realize I had been elevated to the papacy, but thank you very much. Producer Lucas, what should my papal name be? What do you think? Anything strike your fancy? Or,
oh man,
I was thinking Pope Mercury.
Mercury.
I always thought that'd be kind of a cool name.
That's a cool, yeah.
Speedy with his decisions. Anyways, but it's quite, let's get back to John's email. It's quite prideful of you to speak ex cathedra yourself. Furthermore, the church has spoken magisterially on a literal Adam and Eve gathering all humanity, something almost all modern day biologists would call embarrassing. And then he points me toward a debate that's going to be happening in a few days on the young Earth, old Earth question. And he says, you should watch this, check it out. You might learn something. Hear what both sides have to say about the issue. Signed, John. Okay, well, John, let me say, first of all, I'm not speaking ex cathedra. I'm not speaking on behalf of the church. I'm simply listing my opinion on this. And you are correct that the church has not taught magisterially on the issue. And so just as you're offering your opinion, I'm offering mine. You can take it or leave it. Now, with respect to your question about Adam and Eve, that the church has said that there has to be a literal Adam and Eve. What the church does say about that is as follows, that there is an original sin that did take place, that did infect all of humanity. And for various theological reasons, things don't really work out so well if there isn't an actual first couple or first Adam. And even if you hold to an evolutionary point of view, by the way, there are ways to reconcile this with the Catholic faith. For example, when it says in Genesis that God created the first man out of the dust of the earth, some people say, and I'm not saying you have to believe this, I'm not even saying that I believe this, that could have taken place over an evolutionary period of time. That phrase, created man out of the dust of the earth, could have taken place over a great period of time, and it really has to do with the question of where the human body came from. So even if you hold to an evolutionary process for how the human body came to be, you would have to hold the Catholic faith, you would have to posit that at some point in the process, God infused an eternal, immortal soul into an individual who would be considered to be Adam. So there are ways to reconcile this with an evolutionary point of view. And again, I'm not saying I hold to that. I'm not saying I hold to that at all. In fact, currently I don't. I don't buy into macroevolution as Darwin conceived it, that a tadpole could become a monkey, which would eventually become an ape, which would eventually become a human. No. One species morphing into another. I don't buy into that. I don't think there's evidence for that in the fossil record. I'm not a scientist. This isn't my background. I do buy into microevolution within species. For example, a giraffe growing a longer neck over time to reach the fruit on the upper branches, whatever the case may be. There are lots of incidents like that. But as far as I know, in the fossil record, there's never been evidence of, for example, a bird that couldn't quite fly, or an eye that was in the process of being formed. Everything is complete. This is what Michael Behe from Lehigh University, in his book Darwin's Black Box, refers to as irreducible complexity. For example, think of the complexity of the human eye. There has never been an eye that couldn't see. It was always complete in and of itself. Or think of DNA, the double helix. That is an incredibly complex situation at its core. The probability of it having evolved from some sort of a chaotic mess is practically zero. So I'm not saying I hold that evolutionary view as Darwinists would hold it at all. But I'm just saying that you could potentially, as a Catholic, hold that view as long as you did hold that at some point God infused an immortal soul into what we would call the first human being, in that sense, Adam. Anyways, more on this. We're having some audio issues on the program right now, so I'm just going to take a quick break right now, but we have some incredible questions from listeners that you are not going to want to miss. I can't wait to share that with you. I'll be right back. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. Today, we'd like to thank Juanito, who is listening in California, for donating his Nissan. Join in with thousands of other listeners to donate your old vehicles by visiting relevantradio.com/car.
Helping you keep your mind off traffic and on the more important things in life. It's Cale Clark on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back to the show on this Mailbag Monday. Apologies for that. We had to take a bit of an early break there. Had a bit of a technical issue. Got that sorted out. Hey, it's live radio. That's what happens. But I was talking about a message that I got, an email that I got from John listening in Los Angeles, he took some issue with some statements that I made on Friday's show. And I had mentioned the young Earth scientific movement was, I called it embarrassing. Maybe I shouldn't have said that. And by the way, I'm open to that being the correct scientific perspective on how old the Earth is. I'm very open to that. And in fact, somebody else had actually sent me a link to a documentary about this where some scientists were actually arguing for this point of view. And I haven't watched it yet. Totally open to that being the case. Right now, I don't think that it is. I'm kind of with that majority view that says that the Earth is very, very old. But at the end of the day, like I said at the beginning, I really don't care, because the book of Genesis is not a science textbook. It's not meant to be a BBC documentary on how the Earth came to be created from a scientific point of view. It's not narrated by David Attenborough, for example. Wasn't he the guy that did the Blue Planet and all that stuff? And apparently he's an atheist, which I think is amazing, because he looks at creation, the beauty of creation, and he doesn't necessarily buy into a divine creator. Strange, but there may be some other things going on there. I don't know. Don't know the man. But the first three chapters of Genesis. Now, when you read the Bible in general, you have to understand what type of literature you're reading. And the Bible, as we talked about last week, and when we looked at the comments of Jordan Peterson on the Joe Rogan program on Spotify, the Joe Rogan podcast, we kind of took apart Jordan Peterson's view of the Bible as he sees it right now. And one thing that Peterson said, which is he's correct about this, is that the Bible isn't so much a book, but it's a library. That is correct. It's a library of 73 books. And of course, there are 27 books in the New Testament, Protestants and Catholics agree on the number of New Testament books. Obviously, Catholic Bibles are bigger. We have a bigger Old Testament catalog. Books have been removed from the Protestant canon. They call them the Apocrypha. We call them the Deuterocanonicals, the seven books that are in Catholic Old Testaments, not in Protestant Old Testaments. We call them the Deuterocanonicals, which means second canon, Deuterocanon. Anyhow, that's another talk for another day, but these books, these 73 books, are different types of literature. There's some historical stuff in there, historical records of the people of Israel, the kings, for example, like King David. We're going to talk about him later in the program. Very interesting story. Biographies of Jesus, the Gospels. These are really Greco-Roman biographies. They fit into that category perfectly. They're not modern-day biographies, as we might like them to be, but they were right into the genre of first-century Greco-Roman biographies, a historical life of Christ, according to the customs of the day. There are personal letters by St. Paul. We're going through one of the letters right now on the Faith Explained program, the letter to the Philippians. It's fascinating to read Paul's personal letters to churches, to individuals, as in the case of Philemon. There's a history of the early church, the Acts of the Apostles. So you get the point. And in the Old Testament, the key is to know what genre you're reading. The key to interpretation is knowing what genre you're reading. If you're reading a book of poetry, like the Song of Solomon, also known as the Song of Songs, you don't read that the same way as you would a historical review of the kings of Israel. You don't read a poem the same way you read a police report. And if your love poems sound like police reports, it's no wonder that, you know, your love life isn't as spicy as you might like it to be. But when it comes to the book of Genesis, it presents a bit of a problem, because Genesis is a very big book. It's a very big book, 50 chapters. And Genesis is a hybrid book. It does have history in it, but it also has some poetry in it as well. And that's what makes it hard for people to interpret the book in some ways. The first three chapters of Genesis, the creation narratives in Genesis, and I say narratives with an S on the end, because there are two creation narratives in Genesis. One of them is kind of a bird's eye view, a more general view, and the other one is a worm's eye view that talks about the nitty-gritty details of the creation of Adam and Eve and their relationship and all that stuff, original sin coming into the world. Again, on the Faith Explained program, we did a whole series on Genesis. So I did go into this at some depth in the Genesis series on the creation narratives. But the creation narratives in Genesis are not intended to be a science textbook on how God created the universe. They are they're from a religious point of view, from a poetical point of view. Why God? First of all, the main point is that God created the world, the universe, humanity. There was as Cardinal Newman said, a great aboriginal calamity in which original sin came into the world. That's what it talks about. Why are things the way they are right now? Gives a lot of answers to those questions. What is the purpose and meaning of human life? But it is not intended to be a how God created the world. That's not what it's intended to do at all. First of all, the writer of Genesis was not there with a smartphone camera set up when this isn't a documentary film when God created the world. So there's a lot we can say about this. The way in which it is written is meant to respond to, and the Israelites obviously were surrounded by all kinds of pagans and all kinds of alternate points of view on who created the universe, how many gods there are, my God's better than your God. And really, a lot of Genesis is to say, no. The God of Israel, Yahweh, is the one true God that created all things. And, okay, you say Baal. He's one of the pagan gods. You've read about him in the Old Testament. Baal is the cloud rider. Well, no, Yahweh is the cloud rider. One of the reasons why God is described the way he is in some of the biblical books of the Old Testament is to, like, it's really an in-your-face, it's a slap in the face to those pagan views. No, actually, the real, true, and living God, the God of Israel, the one true God, is the God that can actually do all these things. So I think it's a misreading of Genesis to look at it. Now, if it is true from a scientific point of view that the earth is only 6,000 years old, again, great, but that's not what Genesis is trying to say. Genesis is trying to give us the why, the ultimate questions here. That God did it, why God did it. God has a special plan for humanity. It's not meant to be a science textbook. So hopefully that is clear as mud. We're going to move on to the next question. If you have a question, by the way, now I'm reading some questions that have been mailed in, emailed in, that is, but you can certainly call in as well, 888-914-9149. We got a couple of lines open right now if you want to call in. Please feel free to do so. Oh, here's one. I better answer this one. This one actually comes from Rod in Toronto, and I know who this is. I see the address. This is actually my father-in-law, so I better answer this, and I better do a good job of it. Hopefully he's still happy that I married his daughter. Certainly, we gave him a wonderful granddaughter, Michaela, and I think he's still happy. I think he's still happy. But he's actually got a really good question here. This is a very good question. I like this. So I'm not answering this just because you're my father-in-law, Rod. I'm answering this because this is a great, great question. So here is the question, and it is simply this. So he's telling me that he's got a friend that he's been trying to share the faith with, and this person keeps, you know, coming back at him with, well, there's all these contradictions in the Bible, and he's got one in particular that really sticks in his craw. If you read the Acts of the Apostles, when it talks about Paul's conversion, and by the way, just the other day was the conversion of St. Paul. We had a whole show about this. It was a lot of fun. In the Acts of the Apostles, when it talks about Paul's conversion, in one place, you know, the famous Damascus Road experience, there's this blinding light. Jesus speaks to him. I am Jesus whom you are persecuting. All that stuff. Paul, it says in one place, Paul's companions heard a voice. And then in another place, when Paul's telling his conversion story, it says that they didn't hear the voice. Okay, well, what's up with that? So this person is saying to my father-in-law, you can't trust the scriptures. This is contradictory. This doesn't make any sense. I don't need to believe this. Okay. So obviously this person is coming, you know, with a hermeneutic of suspicion, as it were. He's definitely not exactly giving the scriptural writer the benefit of the doubt here. And that would be St. Luke, by the way. We know that St. Luke wrote the Acts of the Apostles, and it's kind of the second volume of his two-volume set, as it were, where the Gospel of Luke is volume number one, and the Acts of the Apostles is volume two. That's, you know, put them together, it's about a quarter of the New Testament. It's, you know, Luke wrote a lot of the New Testament, as did St. Paul. The two of them together were amazing. So they're both dedicated to the same person, this guy named Theophilus, which means lover of God. It might just be like the general reader, like everyone's beloved of God, or there might have been an actual guy named Theophilus. But St. Paul's conversion story is mentioned three times in the Acts of the Apostles. And again, as we talked about on the conversion of St. Paul, you simply wouldn't do that under normal circumstances. It's not like today. It's not like we have Google Docs or, you know, the biblical, St. Luke didn't have Microsoft Word. He couldn't just simply use his backspace cursor and just delete everything and start over again. No, there's not an unlimited, infinite supply of writing materials, right? There's papyrus. You got to get ink. You got to get a scribe to do it. Even St. Paul didn't write all his letters himself. He just signed them at the end most of the time. So you'd hire a scribe. So you don't say something three times in the same book unless it is really, really, really meaningful to you. And St. Paul tells his conversion story in Acts chapter 9, in Acts chapter 22, and also in Acts chapter 26. But he emphasizes different things each time. Okay, so what of the apparent contradiction here? Well, here's Acts chapter 9, verse 7. This is the first time it talks about Paul's conversion. It says, "And the men which journeyed with him stood speechless, hearing a voice, but seeing no one." Okay, that's Acts 9, 7. Now, in Acts 22, when St. Paul is talking about his conversion story, it says, "And they that were with me," this is Paul talking here, "and they that were with me saw indeed the light and were afraid, but they heard not the voice of him who spoke to me." Acts 22, verse 9. Okay, so which is it? Did they hear the voice or not hear the voice? Okay, you can kind of see where this guy is coming from here. All right. So here's the answer to the question, or at least I think it's not, there's probably other answers to the question, but this is the one I think is most plausible. First of all, St. Luke is no dummy. St. Paul is no dummy. Okay, so the fact that Paul converted to Catholicism and became the apostle, there isn't a credible historian in the world that doubts that Paul, Saul at the time, he was known as Saul the Pharisee, Rabbi Saul. There is an incredible historian in the world that doubts that Paul became a Christian, that he was a persecutor of the early church movement, and then he became its biggest advocate, its biggest apostle, its biggest evangelist. Nobody doubts that, that he had a conversion experience. Now, they might not buy into the reasons why. They might not believe that in Jesus as he did, as he came to believe in Jesus. But nobody doubts that he went from persecutor to propagator. Okay, so we don't need our Bibles to know that. And it's important for us to know as Catholics that if every copy of the New Testament in the world was zapped up to the Starship Enterprise, beamed up to the Starship Enterprise, and William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy, guess what? We would still know the basic contours of the Christian message, the contours of the life, ministry, miracles, death, resurrection, ascension of Jesus Christ. Because that's all established in other sources, including the conversion of Paul. People talked about this. So, but in term, and Luke also is no dummy. Luke, when you read the New Testament, when you read, if you can read Greek, if you know biblical Greek, it's called Koine Greek. It's not classical Greek, but it's kind of the street language Greek of the day. But if you read the New Testament in its original language, which is Greek, Luke is right up. His Greek is approaching classical Greek. It's so good. Luke and the letter to the Hebrews are the best Greek in the New Testament. They're just exquisitely written. So this guy knows the language. The point of what I'm saying here, Luke knows exactly what he's saying, and he would not make an elementary error. Oh man, I forgot. Back in chapter 9, I said they heard a voice. Oh, darn it. Now in chapter 22, I've said they didn't hear the voice. Oh man, but we've already printed the book. Can't go back. Maybe in the second edition we'll change that. No, he didn't make a mistake. He didn't make a mistake. So here's what's going on here. In the Greek New Testament, the word that's used there is the word akouo. I think I might have pronounced it wrong. But anyways, that doesn't really matter. The point of it is the word that's in question here means two different things. It means to hear, and it also means to understand. So for example, we say this all the time in just, you know, regular speech. Are you not hearing me? Did you not hear me? We might say to somebody. Well, they obviously auditorially, is that even a word? Heard your voice. But when you say that to somebody, are you not hearing me? That means, are you not understanding me? And in the same way, that Greek word that is used in both those cases can mean either one of those things. So it could mean literally hearing the voice, and then it might mean not understanding. So for example, here's some other ways we could translate this. And this is from another Bible translation. So in the Acts chapter 9 situation, we could translate it as this way. And this is from the North American Standard Bible. The men who traveled with him stood speechless, hearing the voice, but seeing no one. Okay, so they did hear something. Okay, in Acts chapter 22, verse 9, we could say this. Those who were with me, Paul talking here, obviously, those who were with me saw the light, to be sure, but did not understand the voice of one who was speaking to me. So it's an apparent contradiction here. So really, in both cases, there's no contradiction. It just means that they did hear something with their ears. They just didn't get it. They didn't understand the message. Paul did, but they did not. The companions did not. So, Rod, you can tell your friend this. Hopefully that will help him a little bit as he's exploring this question. It's not a contradiction. It's not a reason to throw the baby out with the bathwater here with respect to the Bible. Okay. All right, we're going to go to Rose now. We're going to go to the phones right now. Rose is calling from Wisconsin. Hey, Rose, how you doing? Thanks for the call.
Hi, thanks. My son goes to a Catholic high school, and he came home the other day saying that in his religion class, the textbook was saying some weird things. It's kind of related to what you were talking about with Genesis before. Mm-hmm. He said that they said it wasn't really the Red Sea that Moses parted. It was called the Reed Sea, and it was very small. And then he also said that I'm not entirely sure what he was mm-hmm. trying to say, but it seemed like he was saying with Noah's flood that maybe it only flooded a very small mm-hmm. portion of mm-hmm. land rather than the whole earth. And I'm wondering your perspective on those two things.
Okay. Rose, thank you very much for that call. That's actually a good question with respect to what we were talking about with regards to Genesis. Now, okay, the whole Red Sea, Reed Sea thing, I'll leave that for another time. I've read a few things on that. I can't recollect everything I've read about that at the top of my head. That's more to do with, obviously, the Exodus account, the parting of the Red Sea, or the Reed Sea, as it were. But let me do some more research on that. I'm going to make a note of this. We'll get back to the Reed Sea in a bit. But with respect to your other question about, say, the flood, that's another example. Now, earlier I talked about how a lot of people think the first three chapters of Genesis are a poetic account of how God created the universe. But at some point, we do have actual, real, blow-by-blow history in Genesis. And the question is, where does that actually start? Where does that actually start? So some scholars, and all of this would be compatible with a Catholic view, some scholars say this. And I remember the first time I heard this, I thought, I don't necessarily buy this. But the more I think about it, the more I'm drawn to this. I'm not saying I've made a decision on this 100%, but some people say that the real history in Genesis doesn't start happening until chapter 11, chapter 12. So it's Genesis 1 to 11 in this view, and again, I'm not saying this is me holding this view, I'm just laying this out for you. Some people say that the first 11 chapters of Genesis are not meant to be literal history, but they're meant to present truths about early history, early humanity. And that, by the way, Genesis 11 is the Tower of Babel incident. And then Genesis 12, we have Abraham. And from that point, from Genesis 12 on, it's a lot easier to nail down people, places, dates, events, rulers, like actual, we can kind of nail this down a lot easier from a historical point of view. So some people think up to 11, and that would include the flood, by the way, is not meant to be taken historically. And others say, no. There's good evidence to think that there is a historical flood. Okay. I've read some of the science on this, and we dealt with it a little bit, again, in way more detail on the Genesis series on the Faith Explained podcast. So you can look for that, relevantradio.com. Just look up the Faith Explained program. But when we talked about the flood, there are different points of view on that. Some people think that it was a local flood. Like, in other words, it wasn't the whole planet. Some people think that. Some people think there's a lot of scientific evidence for that. And you got to remember, to these people writing at that point, to them it would be, even if it was sort of a localized area, which would be still a pretty large area, but to them it would be like the entire world being flooded at that point. Some people think it was a total planetary thing. Possible. One thing I've always found interesting about the flood is that virtually every ancient religion, and I'm no expert on ancient religions, non-Christian religions, but virtually every ancient religion thinks that there was some, in every ancient people group, thinks that there was some sort of a flood. Almost every culture has a flood-type narrative. Think about the Epic of Gilgamesh. You probably heard about that in school growing up. That's another account of the flood, with all these gods and goddesses fighting with each other, Marduk and all these people, the Babylonian Epic of Gilgamesh. So that tends to make me think something happened. But then it's a question of interpreting the event. And again, Israel would say, no, the true God was kind of behind all this, Yahweh, not Marduk and, I forget the name of the other Babylonian quote-unquote gods and goddesses that were involved in this whole thing. They're fighting with each other. The people are too noisy down there, so we've got to send a flood. They're making too much noise. We can't sleep. These petty humans, let's flood them. I'm simplifying it a little bit, but that's kind of the story. And again, I just think that sort of lends some credence to something did happen historically. So there's a lot of different ways to look at it. Which I think would be compatible with a Catholic view and a high view of scripture. And again, the question all comes back to what type of literature is this? What type of literature are you reading? Is it meant to be history? Is it meant to be a poetic account? Still obviously communicating truth, but in a different way. And again, it all comes into the question of genre. And Genesis is tricky because there are different genres of literature within Genesis. There's solid history of the patriarchs that's more of a historical narrative, and there's other poetic stuff. So I think we'll just leave that there. But good question, Rose. Really, really appreciate your question. And if you have a question, you can also call in 888-914-9149. I'm going to go to the next one here. We're going to take a break in just a second. But before I do that, this is a question about our show that we did on Jordan Peterson and his recent appearance on the Joe Rogan podcast. And this comes to us from Anthony, who is listening on the internet. So Anthony says, "Hey, Cale, I often hear Catholic intellectuals decry modernism and postmodernism. And in addition to finding that condemnation a bit facile, I also think it ignores the catastrophic effects of the two world wars in the 20th century." And this is, again, Anthony writing here, listening on the internet. And I'm going to quote him again. He says, "Let me back up and say that I am a practicing Catholic revert." Hey, so welcome home, Anthony. I'm a revert as well. That's great. He says, "I'm coming from the same place as you are and accept the teachings of the church. Anyway, Cale, I think that writers, artists, musicians, and thinkers of the early 20th century thoroughly realized the importance of the shared underpinning of Judeo-Christian values and thinking." And by the way, this is probably a reference to how Jordan Peterson was trying to say that the Bible is the foundation for a lot of Western culture and thought. We dealt with this on the episode last week. It was a fun discussion. Please check that out in the podcast. We'll put a link to it in the show notes for this for today's show. So he says, "I think a lot of the writers, artists, musicians, and thinkers of the early 20th century thoroughly realized the importance of the shared underpinning of Judeo-Christian values and thinking. But they came to the conclusion that those values couldn't be a source of truth because they led us to the senseless slaughter of millions in World War I and, of course, the Holocaust in World War II. So that's on us, as it were, for number one, not living up to the gospel message, and number two, not offering a satisfactory explanation for the catastrophes afterward. I guess what I'm saying is it's not that these intellectuals just decided one day to blow everything up because it was fashionable. They were searching for the truth, and we failed them." End of quote. Okay, so thanks very much for your message, Anthony. And I think if I understand you correctly, I'm going to actually agree with you with one of the things that you're saying here, that he's basically saying that when you look at the two world wars, a lot of the nations that were behind these wars were allegedly Christian nations. How could this really have happened if they were living Christian values? Therefore, I'm rejecting Christianity. That's what a lot of people are saying. And I do think that is the reason why. My answer to that is they simply weren't living up to the gospel message. There's no question about it. One of the most chilling things that you'll ever see is if you do go to the Holy Land, and I always take people here when I go to the Holy Land because I think it's important for them to see this, the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial outside of Jerusalem is a very sobering account of what happened leading up to the Holocaust itself. And you kind of walk through this very, if you've been there, you know what I'm talking about. It's not an easy experience by any stretch of the imagination. It's very powerful. It's very disturbing. It's also very moving. And as you walk through this, it's a very long kind of hallway. And it starts off with talking about, there's like news clippings, editorial cartoons that were being written up in Germany prior to World War II, during the rise of Hitler, that sort of thing. And a question a lot of people ask is how could an advanced, intellectually elite, allegedly Christian nation like Germany allow such a thing to happen? And after the fall, it's a bit of a complicated question, but after the fallout of World War I, Germany was undergoing a lot of economic problems, and the Jews became a very convenient scapegoat. And so eventually they began to be dehumanized. You see this in the writings, in the cartoons, in the culture, in the media. And once you strip away someone's humanity, you can do to them whatever you want. And the same is true, by the way, with the modern day Holocaust of abortion as well. It's a denial of the humanity of the unborn. That's been talked about at length on Relevant Radio. I don't think we need to really revisit that right now. But it's very, very chilling that this happened, and it could happen again in the modern world. It could easily happen. So, it's a failure to live the demands of the gospel. There's no question about it. And so, yeah, it is sobering indeed. So thank you very much for your email, Anthony. Really appreciate that. And we've got a really good one. Oh, man, I can't wait to share this with you. But producer Lucas is telling me we've got to take a break. So you're going to have to hang on here. I can't wait to share the next one with you. It's a Mailbag Monday on The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 888-914-9149. It can also be a phone call Monday, so you can call in. Talk to you soon. Be right back after this break. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
This is The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the program. It's a Mailbag Monday on The Cale Clark Show, but you can also call in to 888-914-9149. But before we do that, before we get to your phone calls, there are some people on the line here. I do want to read an email I got from a guy named John Patmos, which normally I would never read someone's last name or give out their email address on the show. But this time I did read the person's full name because I'm pretty sure it's not his actual name. John Patmos. By the way, the reason why I think that is because the book of Revelation traditionally is ascribed to the Apostle John, who was writing on the island of Patmos, where he was in exile for his Catholic faith. Anyway, so this is what John Patmos says. He's listening in Los Angeles, also on 9:30 a.m. KHJ. And the subject of the email is Truth Alert. Truth Alert, Truth Alert, Truth Alert. Okay, so the message is, fear God immediately and completely in your compromised state. You know not the truth. God has recently authored 400 letters through an unnamed vessel, illuminating his word, explaining the details for salvation, and preparing mankind for eternity in these last of the last days. Well, thanks, John, for reaching out and telling me about this, but I don't buy it. And then he gives a link. I'm not going to give the link to you because I'm 100% sure this is bogus. And I'll tell you why, because if God wanted people to know crucial information for their salvation, he wouldn't be doing it in this way, through this unnamed person dictating 400 different letters. He'd be passing that on publicly through the one holy Catholic and apostolic church. Again, the Catholic Church is not a secret organization. There were in the early church, even there were lots of little splinter groups that left the Catholic Church. Gnostic groups, little sects that broke off from the church, and they would say things like, oh, we have the truth about Jesus. We've got the real inside scoop. You got to join our group, though, to find this out. Once we initiate you, then we'll tell you what's really going on here. And that still happens today with a lot of groups like the Mormons. They don't tell you the whole scoop when they come to your door. They don't tell you that they think that every Mormon male will become a god on his own planet someday. We did some shows about this on The Faith Explained. Actually, we even had an ex-Mormon who's now a Catholic come in for an interview. That was illuminating, and we've got that up on YouTube as well. So maybe producer Lucas, we can put a link to that one in the show notes as well. Anyways, so it's not an esoteric secret club. Okay, this is public revelation. The Catholic Church's teachings have always been public, and God wanted it to be public, the way of salvation, so everybody could figure this out. So I highly doubt that even if this is from God, we don't have to buy into private revelations, even the approved private revelations of the church. Somebody called in about this last week as well. Someone said, I don't believe in any of the Marian apparitions, even the approved ones that the church has approved. Fine, you can still be a Catholic in good standing, because the church says you don't have to believe any of the public or private revelations, even the approved ones. You only have to believe the public teaching of the church, public revelation. So this would be, even if it was true, a private revelation. I don't think it is. And sorry, John, from Patmos. That's consigned to the dustbin. All right, let's go now to the phones. Let's go to Luz, who's calling from Largo in Florida. Hello, Luz. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I'd like to say that I've never been able to call into a program and talk.
Okay.
I'm very frightened at the moment for various reasons.
Okay.
I fear the salvation.
You're fearful of your salvation?
For my salvation. Fearful of my salvation.
Okay, okay. Well, here's one thing that may give you some comfort, and then I'll maybe pass you back to Patrick, who took your call, and maybe he can point you towards some resources that can help you. But I would say, Luz, that one thing that the New Testament says is that perfect love, speaking of the Apostle John, I mentioned him a moment ago, perfect love casts out all fear. So there's the fear of the Lord, right, which the Bible talks about, which is an awe, a reverence, a respect for God, for sure. But this idea of walking around being very fearful of, does God love me? And I'm not sure this is where you're coming from, but does God love me? Does he care for me? Can he forgive my sins? I don't know. That's the kind of fear that, well, I guess there's a good side of it, because if we actually have committed a serious sin and we know that things aren't right spiritually, that's a sign that we need to get to confession. You know, if you're a Catholic, and I don't know if you are, but yeah. If we've committed what's called a mortal sin, you can certainly, and you should go to confession for that. And that often gives people a lot of peace when they go to confession. It gets rid of that sort of thing. But we can never doubt God's love for us, his desire to forgive us. And hey, this is why Jesus did what he did for us. The fact that, even as St. Paul said, St. Paul did some terrible things before he accepted the Lord Jesus. He persecuted his people. He persecuted Jesus. We know this from his writings. I'm going to actually talk about this a little bit on the Faith Explained program tomorrow. But St. Paul said, the Son of God loved me and gave himself for me personally. He hung on the cross, his blood dripped into the sand, and he would have done that if I was the only person left on planet Earth. So never doubt God's love for you. He wants you to know him. He wants you to be reconciled with him. And this is one of the reasons why he's given us the Catholic Church to share the gospel with every creature. And so hopefully that's helpful to you, Luz. And I'm just going to pass you back to Patrick Alog, and maybe he can help you, give you some resources, some people that you could talk to, maybe some counseling that we could refer you to. But I do thank you for calling in, Luz. God bless you. All right, we're going to go to Kenneth in Rock Island, Illinois. Hello, Kenneth. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi.
Hey. What's your question?
My question is, do you recommend seeing the movie Father Stu with Mel Gibson and Mark Wahlberg?
And Marky Mark. Mark Wahlberg, yeah, he used to be Marky Mark in the Funky Bunch, but that was a long time ago. but having said that, I don't know if you remember that, but you know that I've heard bits and pieces about this movie.
I'm 74, so I'm a lot younger than you.
Pardon me?
I don't remember that. I'm 74. I'm a lot younger than you.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, his brother Donnie Wahlberg was in New Kids on the Block. That's another story for another day. But having said that, apparently Mark Wahlberg is, and I don't have any inside information on this, but apparently he is a practicing Catholic, so I'm told. Now, some might say, how could he make the movies he makes if he's a practicing Catholic? Like, I don't want to get into that, but that's, you do hear stories about him going to Mass, taking his family to Mass. He's talked about his faith publicly. Can't comment on that right now. But in terms of this movie, the movie Father Stu, I don't know much about this. Apparently, it comes out in April, this movie. It's about a boxer who becomes a priest. But as far as I know, there's not even a trailer out for this movie yet. So I know about as much about it as you do, Kenneth. So maybe when it comes out.
Supposedly, he was an atheist, and he got in a motorcycle accident, and He was declared dead and then had a experience with the Lord and then became a priest. But, you know, what's funny about that one, I don't know what, if you use the word funny, but, you know, that's jargon, I guess. He died at 50.
Wow. Okay. Huh. I didn't know. So this is something I'm going to have to watch out for. Who knows? And thanks for the call, Kenneth. I appreciate that. We unfortunately, we're up against the clock. I wish I had another hour, but maybe we'll get Mark Wahlberg on the show. Hey, Marky Mark, if you're listening, love to have you. Love to chop it up with you. But no, I'm not aware of that film, but it sounds intriguing. Okay, so there are a number of people who, Tom, Paul, Will, I'm sorry that we didn't get your calls, but you can always call back tomorrow on the Cale Clark Show. We can talk about more of your questions, as always. I didn't even get through half of the mailbag, Lucas. So, man, we got to get back to this. So we'll do more of this week. And keep them coming. Keep them coming. Lots to chat about, lots to talk about when it comes to everything, right? And that's what the word Catholic is all about, right? It's universal. It has to touch all of life. And it's been a slice of life with you today on the show. Lucas Holt produced. Patrick Alog took your calls. We didn't even talk about the Super Bowl. We'll have to do that later, too. Anyways, God bless. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.